Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The cannon boomed, white smoke blasting forth from the bronze muzzle, the sound carrying across the lapping waves of the Mediterranean. The iron ball whistled through the air, cutting across the bow of the fat merchantman. It didn't strike the ship, but it came much closer than the captain wished. He was a rotund, gray-bearded little man, a native of Alexandria, and he had been traveling the sea lanes between Egypt and Istanbul for decades with cargoes of spices, silks, and more mundane ceramics and woolens. Violence was common here in the year 1563, and the captain was no stranger to it, but he had prayed for decades to avoid this particular source of cannonballs. Actually, it was less the cannon than the banner flying above the deck of the low, lean war galley, its oars pulling at the water, that worried him. A white cross on a red background, the symbol of the Hospitaller Knights of Malta. The cannon couldn't have sent a clearer message. Stop and be boarded. The captain barked orders in Arabic. They had no hope of escape. The Hospitaller galley, with its oars driven by the aching arms and backs of Muslim slaves, was far faster than their rather ungainly tub. The captain might have tried to make a fight of it against common pirates. The ship had plenty of bows, arquebuses, and a few cannon of its own, but not against Hospitallers. "Stop the ship," the captain said, "and prepare to be boarded." The galley pulled up alongside. Looking down from their higher deck, the captain saw armored figures in red surcoats, big swords and pole axes in their gauntleted hands. Hospitallers, the captain knew. Mercenaries pointed handguns and crossbows in their direction. The cannon that had fired earlier was loaded and aimed directly at them. One of the knights clambered on board, his long sword gleaming in his hand. A grin split his scarred, brown-bearded face, visible in his visorless helmet. He should be smiling. This was a rich hall, luxuries that would sell nicely in any port in Christendom. His grin revealed that he was missing a few teeth. The captain sighed. "If I'm lucky," he thought, "perhaps the knight will let me live. Then again, maybe he won't." Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. For the better part of the past 3 years, Tides of History has focused on the later Middle Ages and the early modern period, from the Black Death to the middle of the 16th century, with occasional excursions earlier and later. The time is fast approaching when we'll leave this era behind. Our next topic will be prehistory, from the dawn of humanity to the end of the Bronze Age. It's going to be a lot of fun, I promise. Neanderthals, megafauna like saber-toothed tigers and mammoths, the Ice Age. Recent advances in genetics and archaeology are transforming our understanding of the deep past, and it's pretty amazing stuff. So this isn't as far as I was thinking I would get in the late medieval and early modern periods. I was hoping to hit the 30 Years' War and the beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. But after surveying all the topics, I realized just how much there would have been to cover between about 1550 and 1650. That's at least a couple of years' worth of episodes. And to be completely honest with you, I wasn't sure I could sustain my interest in this area for long enough to cover everything with the kind of enthusiasm and attention to detail that you all expect from me, that I expect from myself. I'd rather switch to something that I'm excited to dive into, which I am with prehistory, rather than keep going on a topic that I feel a bit tired of. 3 years, dozens of episodes, and a book coming before too long, that's a lot of stuff. I hope you'll understand my reasoning and stick with me as we make the transition. I promise it's going to be fascinating. But before we get there, we have two final episodes to wrap things up. If we weren't going to get all the way to 1650-ish, this was our last good stopping point. The next things up would have been the Dutch Revolt, the Price Revolution, and global expansion, along with the rise of the Atlantic world. Those felt like fundamentally new processes rather than straightforward continuations. Instead of getting into all that, we'll finish off with something that feels like an organic conclusion to what we've been covering. The decades-long war between the Habsburgs and the Ottomans for control over the Mediterranean, which culminated in the Great Siege of Malta in 1565 and the Battle of Lepanto, one of the largest naval battles in history, in 1571. To help us really dig into the texture of this world and what made these enormous conflicts possible, we're going to follow two composite characters, one Christian and one Muslim. They'll take a journey through the long, bitter decades of this seaborne war before it finally reaches its epic conclusion at Malta and Lepanto. This was an age of pirates seizing merchant ships on the sea lanes of the Mediterranean, corsairs swooping down on unsuspecting villages to grab captives to sell into slavery, and squadrons of lean war galleys clashing in titanic battles to the sound of gunfire, crunching wood, and clanging steel. We'll get a front row seat to all of that. Let's start with the Mediterranean. The sea has a long history, not just because of the things that happened in it, there were a lot of them, but because of an ever-changing history of the sea. So I'm borrowing here from a great book by the historians Peregrine Horton and Nicholas Purcell called The Corrupting Sea. It's one of my favorites. Basically, we have to understand the Mediterranean as not only the water, but the lands around it, the regions that the sea drew together with ties of politics, war, migration, and above all, trade. Those patterns shifted from era to era. The Roman Empire united the entirety of the Mediterranean under the rule of a single political entity. It brought together Alexandria and Rome, Marseille and Antioch, Constantinople and Carthage, in a way that had never been the case before and never would be again. You could get fine wine from Gaza in Italy and North African pottery up the Rhone River in what's now France. Christianity spread across the Roman world from the Levant to the Straits of Gibraltar thanks to the maritime connectivity of the Mediterranean. The possibilities for connection, for mobility and exchange of all kinds were never greater than at the height of the Roman Empire. After the rise and spread of Islam in the early Middle Ages, a basic religious gap divided the Mediterranean. Now, this was never enough to stop trade or cultural contact. We've talked before about the Venetians, the Mediterranean merchants par excellence, and how their city's economy relied on business with both the Byzantines and the Muslim world. They were just one of many examples. The Jewish merchants of Cairo, the Muslim traders of the Maghreb, and the Genoese Christians all did business across deep cultural and religious divides. But the patterns of connectivity shifted. The way places were tied together, the forces bringing them into contact and exchanging goods and people and ideas, all of that changed. Religious war, crusade, jihad, Gaza, became part of the bedrock experience of Mediterranean life, everywhere from Spain to the Levant. The start of the 16th century, where we'll begin our story proper, saw another profound series of shifts in connectivity. Several of the threads we've discussed over the past year all collided. The end of the Reconquista in Spain and the harsh treatment of Muslims that went along with it, the rise of the Ottoman Empire as a world power, and the emergence of the Habsburgs, particularly Charles V, as a Mediterranean-spanning figure. All of this took place in a general framework of economic growth. Populations rose, emerging out of the post-Black Death downturn. Hard currency, in short supply in Europe throughout the 15th century, flowed into the Mediterranean in increasing amounts. Gold from West Africa, both via the Atlantic route in Portugal and across the Sahara, and silver, first from Central Europe and then later from the Americas. Trade rose in volume as the new routes around Africa and to the Americas stimulated demand for imported luxuries. Even local exchange became more pervasive and more lucrative. All of this meant that despite the increasing globalization of the age, the expansion into the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic and beyond, the Mediterranean remained a prize worth fighting over. The new players coming onto the scene were capable of doing that on a previously unimagined scale. And that is our story here. So that story begins in Spain in the late 1480s. As the forces of the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, pressed hard on the final Muslim state of the Iberian Peninsula, Granada, its emirs looked far and wide for help. They sent envoys to the other side of the Mediterranean, to the great but distant Muslim powers of the East, the Mamluks who ruled in Egypt, the Levant, and Syria, and the Ottomans who controlled Anatolia and the Balkans. The Ottoman Sultan Bayezid II was interested enough to send a fleet to the western reaches of the Mediterranean. The Ottoman ships didn't arrive in time or in enough numbers to turn back the tide of Castilian and Aragonese aggression. Granada surrendered at the beginning of 1492. But they did raid the Spanish coast and evacuate Muslim refugees fleeing their new and intolerant rulers. This was a small confrontation, but it showed how the religious strife between Christianity and Islam played into a potentially emerging geopolitical conflict between the ascendant Ottomans and a rising Spain. And then, of course, there were the people caught in the middle. The conquest of Granada led to Muslim rebellions in the closing years of the 15th century. The Spanish response was brutal and thorough. Forced conversions, massacres, and voluntary exile for those who could afford to pay the fee that King Ferdinand demanded. Some of those Muslim refugees ended up in the Ottoman Empire, which welcomed them. Others, far more, settled in the Maghreb and the great trading cities of the North African coast. Iran, Algiers, Tunis, and many others filled up with people born in Granada and Malaga, the last outposts of Islam in Iberia. Understandably, those refugees weren't especially fond of the Christian rulers who had turfed them out of their home. They had intimate knowledge of the Spanish coastline, out-of-the-way coves where ships could hide, where the still Muslim villagers might offer them food or shelter, and most of all, where there was rich plunder to be taken. Now, piracy and raiding weren't new at the beginning of the 16th century. Prince Henry the Navigator of Portugal, the famous funder of explorations down the West African coast, had been an even more prolific funder of corsairs preying on both Muslim and Christian shipping in the first half of the 15th century. He was one of many. What changed at the dawn of the new century, after the conquest of Granada, was the dimension of the conflict. Revenge came into play. The religious aspects of the conflict became more obvious, and now the Ottomans were taking an interest. This was the point when new players entered the scene. Corsairing and piracy weren't restricted to the Western Mediterranean. If anything, seaborne raiding and war with a slightly religious tinge was even more common in the Eastern Mediterranean. The Hospitallers of Rhodes, an order of monks/knights left over from the Crusades, funded their aspirations for a return to crusading by preying on Muslim shipping between Constantinople, Syria, Egypt, and the Levant. On the other side, Muslim corsairs loosely aligned with the Ottomans seized Christian shipping, operating out of the coastline of Anatolia, the islands of the Aegean, and the Balkans. Among those Muslim corsairs were four brothers, originally from the Aegean island of Lesbos: Oruç, Ilyas, Ishak, and Hizir. Oruç was the first of the brothers to turn to the seafaring life, and he quickly made a name for himself as a sailor and a raider. Ilyas joined him, and the two had a successful run raiding Christian shipping in the Eastern Mediterranean in the late 1490s. The Hospitallers caught up to them off the coast of Crete. Ilyas was killed, and Oruç was taken captive. According to legend, Hizir helped him escape from the knight's castle, but it's more likely that an Ottoman governor paid his ransom. After his release, Oruç increased the scale of his raiding. He took command of a squadron of warships under the patronage of an Ottoman prince named Korkut. Now, this Ottoman connection is essential to remember. Oruç and his two remaining brothers, Ishak and Hizir, weren't free agents. When they turned their attention westward to North Africa in the first years of the 16th century, they did so with the knowledge and backing of Ottoman officials. The relationship was a little unclear. Brothers weren't Ottoman officials, and they had until recently served a now disgraced and executed Ottoman prince, Shehadze Korkut. But the lines of communication, this is key to remember, stayed open. It didn't take long for these adventurers to make a name for themselves. They took Christian shipping, even capturing a pair of galleys belonging to the Pope and an Aragonese ship loaded with important noblemen right off the coast of Italy. Over the years to come, Oruç and his brothers took ships, raided coastlines, and helped Muslims escape from Spain and reach the coast of North Africa. Oruç in particular grew famous. His red beard earned him the nickname Barbarossa, a moniker that stuck to all three of the remaining brothers. Now, there was money in corsairing, a lot of it, but Oruç and the others were every bit as interested in genuine political power. They offered their ships, soldiers, and growing wealth to the rulers of the Muslim states of North Africa. In return, they received secure bases, like the island of Djerba off the coast of Tunisia and later the port of La Goleta near Tunis itself. Oruç forged alliances with the Berber tribes and key political factions in the port cities, with an eye toward eventual takeover. Now, this wasn't a straightforward Ottoman conquest of North Africa, but it was hardly a mystery whom the brothers ultimately served. Their forces included hundreds and occasionally thousands of the fearsome Janissaries, the personal slave soldiers of the Sultan, and Oruç and his brothers maintained regular contact with Istanbul. When Oruç made a move, like seizing control of the key port of Algiers in 1516, he did so with an eye toward how Sultan Selim the Grim would receive it. In 1517, the next year, Oruç formally offered his new city to the Ottomans. Selim naturally accepted. Oruç soon met his end, killed and beheaded by the combined forces of Tlemcen, a Muslim state, and Spain the next year, 1518. His brother Ishak was killed in the same battle. By this point, the Spanish were deeply involved in North Africa. They sent regular expeditions to seize key points, they made alliances with Muslim dynasties like that of Tlemcen, and maintained outposts in strategic places. Thanks to the Barbarossas and the lengthening reach of Spain, the North African coast was becoming an imperial battleground. So too was the whole Mediterranean. There was one Barbarossa brother left, Khizr, who was now better known as Khayr ad-Din, goodness of the faith. Khayr ad-Din Barbarossa dyed his beard red with henna to live up to his moniker and his brother's fearsome reputation. Uruç had been a bad man, ruthless and feared across the Mediterranean, a figure who inaugurated a new age of trans-Mediterranean disruption and war. As important as all that was, Khayr ad-Din would leave a much deeper and more impactful legacy.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It's time to meet the friends who will guide us through the coming decades of bitter conflict. These are composite characters, not real people. But as always, I hope they'll give us some emotional grounding and help us understand the texture and lived experience of their world. We've talked about the Hospitallers, the Order of St. John, several times here on Tides. The Hospitallers were a knightly order, half monks, half warriors, a peculiar kind of institution that had been quite popular during the heady days of the Crusades. The Templars are the best known of the bunch. The Teutonic Knights carved out a state for themselves in the Baltic, but the Hospitallers lasted the longest. They were kicked out of the Holy Land along with everybody else before eventually settling on the island of Rhodes, just off the coast of Anatolia, where they remained for more than 200 years. Seaborne warfare became their specialty. The knights became accomplished and increasingly aristocratic pirates. Their banner, a white cross on a red field, struck fear into the hearts of even the most hardened Muslim seafarer. For two centuries, they were a thorn in the side of the Muslim world, raiding trade routes and capturing pilgrims bound for Mecca and Medina. Mehmet the Conqueror besieged their island stronghold in 1480 and failed to take it, and Suleiman the Magnificent finally succeeded in kicking them out after a long, bloody, and draining siege in 1522. It took the knights a few years, but they eventually found a new home, the desolate but strategically vital island of Malta, just south of Sicily. From Malta, the knights could continue their holy piracy, safeguarding the gates of Christendom in the face of the increasingly aggressive Ottomans and their allies in North Africa. So let's get to know one of them. I mentioned a moment ago that the knights were highly aristocratic. As the centuries wore on, only the most blue-blooded and noble families in Europe could hope to place one of their sons, and the knights were all men, in the Order of St. John. It took detailed proof of generations of nobility and a hefty cash payment to get a young man into the more elevated classes of the Hospitallers. So that means our new friend must have been born into an exceptionally prominent family. As for geographic origins, though, he could have been from just about anywhere. The order was firmly international, with properties all across the continent. Organizationally, it had 8 langues, tongues, each of which corresponded to a different region of Western Europe. Aragon, Castile, Italy, the Holy Roman Empire, the Kingdom of France, Auvergne, and Provence. If that sounds like it leaned French, well, it did. It's not that surprising, since France was the cradle of both knightly chivalry and noble pretensions. So with that in mind, our friend will be French. Let's say he's from Picardy, north of Paris, land of towering castles housing the powerful nobles who dominated the fertile, rolling countryside. We'll call our friend Jean. Jean was born in 1515, the fifth surviving child and third and youngest son of an important nobleman with estates all over Picardy, Artois, and Boulogne. He had close ties to the new king, Francis I. Jean's father wasn't present for his birth in 1515. Instead, he was at the Battle of Marignan, fighting alongside his king against the Swiss. So was his eldest brother, just turned 16, who would inherit most of the family estates. Jean's father intended a career in the church for the middle brother. With their connections, he could rise high. A bishopric, for sure, but maybe even a cardinal. For Jean, though, what was left? He wouldn't be inheriting much of anything, not with two elder brothers. His two sisters would both need substantial dowries if they were going to make the kinds of advantageous marriages Jean's father intended for them. But Jean couldn't simply be left to loaf around the family's estates. He would need a path in life. Perhaps a professional soldier, a gendarme leading a squadron of men-at-arms in the standing army of France? He could make a fine career for himself doing that. But Jean's father had another idea in mind, something that would give the family great prestige. Jean would become a Hospitaller, a Knight of the Order of St. John. There was no better way for a noble family to signal just how prestigious its ancestry was, how exalted they were, than joining the Hospitallers. To join the higher levels of the order, that kind of birth was a prerequisite. This wasn't entirely unexpected. Members of Jean's family had been joining the order for two centuries. They had served as advisors to Grand Masters, priors, essentially the regional directors of France, and as commanders of the order's galley fleet. In fact, this was a common pattern. Service in the order tended to run in families. Powerful families. The Hospitallers weren't some poverty-stricken group of religious scratching out a living in a rundown monastery. They had properties all over Europe, vast and varied estates whose revenues funded the order's activities. They produced grain, wine, beer, wool, anything that could be turned into cash or favors. In fact, most of the order's members weren't actually warriors, they were administrators. Running a vast empire of properties was a big job. It's not surprising, given what we've discussed over the course of Tides, but war was expensive and getting more so. The order's fortifications on roads, the ones that cost Suleiman the Magnificent so dearly to besiege in 1522, cost an eye-watering amount of money. Galleys were pricey. Armor, swords, gunpowder, the services of experienced mercenaries to man the fortifications, provisions for the knights, soldiers, and the slaves who rode the galleys. All of that cost money. And who had money? Powerful people in the church. For a member of an important family, like Jean's, placing a son in the knights built connections to both the church hierarchy and the secular political authorities, all of which came in handy for an aspiring noble dynasty. And so Jean's path in life was set. He himself didn't have much say in this, but then choice wasn't the point. The family was what mattered, its reputation and its future, and Jean's father had laid out a viable and honorable path for his youngest son. It helped that it fit with Jean's conception of himself and his role in the world. Nobility was in his blood, and nobody was more noble than the Hospitallers. His worldview was chivalric in nature. Not our modern parody of the concept, but the lived reality for noblemen of the age, which revolved around skillful violence as a marker of social status and personal quality. And there were no better targets for that skillful violence than the enemies of the faith. Who did all of that better than the Hospitallers? After all, his education was mostly martial. Sure, he learned to read and write, but writing and fighting were what mattered. His household growing up was full of soldiers. His father and brothers, even the one destined for the church, spent their spare time hunting, riding through the countryside of Picardy, and training at arms. The stories they told, the literature they read, all of it revolved around war and especially crusading. By the time he was 12 years of age, Jean knew what his future would be, and it agreed with him. 1527. That was the year Jean's father presented his son's proof of nobility to a brother of the order. Jean saw a Hospitaller for the first time. Not a knight in armor, but a rather aged gentleman with a full white beard riding a placid old mare. The man was a manager who ran one of the Hospitaller's estates in Picardy, not a soldier, though he still wore a distinctive black surcoat with a white cross. But his activities, maximizing the estate's profit and securing new donations, were what made the Order's warlike ambitions possible. He took the requisite fee from Jean's father, a small bag full of gold, and pronounced Jean's bloodlines good enough to join their exalted ranks. But the boy's formal induction would have to wait a little while longer. For the moment, since their expulsion from Rhodes, the Order lacked a home. Jean might as well wait until they found one. So it was in 1530 that Jean, now 15 years old, made his way to a luxuriously decorated hospital or chapel near Paris to take his formal vows. He was already technically a novice of the Order, and he and two others, also young men of exceedingly noble birth, would all be invested as full members together. A brother knight, scarred and white-bearded, sat near the altar with a tonsured priest. Jean's father watched with pride as his son took the oath. Yes, Jean said, with the help of God, he wanted to become a hospitaller and maintain the ideals of the Order of St. John. To cement the transaction, and it was a transaction, Jean's father handed over a large, heavy bag of gold. Within days, Jean was headed south. He had a brand new set of plate armor, a large sword, a pole axe, and a lance, all of which he already knew how to use. His new life, a life on a desolate island in the Mediterranean far from the place of his birth, was waiting for him. So Jean came from one of the noblest families in France. Our second friend's blood wasn't anywhere near that blue. Like Jean, he was born in 1515, but his father wasn't a great nobleman with ties to the king. Instead, he was a humble fisherman, plying the waters of the Tyrrhenian Sea from a small village in southern Italy, south of Naples, near Amalfi. His mother died shortly after giving birth to him, but she lived long enough to name him Giovanni. Like Jean, Giovanni was born a Christian. The difference was that Giovanni didn't stay that way. While Jean spent his early years learning to ride expensive war horses and fight with a sword and everything else a noble youth was supposed to do, Giovanni spent his days working on his father's tiny fishing boat. Jean handled weapons, Giovanni used nets to catch fish and a knife to gut them, and he learned to sail and read the shifting winds and currents of the Mediterranean. Around the same time Jean was taking his oaths and traveling south to Malta, Giovanni and his father went out on their boat and left the Amalfitan coast behind. They were headed out towards the island of Capri, into waters they knew well. It was a short voyage they'd made dozens of times, and it would go quickly on this blustery, slightly threatening morning. They hugged the rocky shore, keeping it in sight as much as they could in case a storm blew up, and they made good time. But this wasn't their lucky day. As they rounded the last headland peeking out toward the west, the weather cleared up and the wind died down. Giovanni looked back at the protected cove behind them. Three low, lean ships were sheltering there, like them looking for a place safe from a potential storm. But these weren't fishing boats. These were galleons, small warships driven by a mixture of sails and oars. Now that the wind had faded, Giovanni's little fishing boat was motionless. The galleons were not. He saw their oars start to dip down into the water. The ships got closer. He saw bearded faces, turbans, curved bows, and swords. They were corsairs, operating out of Algiers, and Giovanni and his father were now their prisoners. Giovanni spent the next 3 years chained to the oar of a galley, a slender and lethal warship, pulling back and forth across the waters of the Mediterranean. Seated at his miserable bench, the sun and spray pounded him. Giovanni was barely given enough to eat, even as he pulled and pulled and pulled some more. The fear gripped him when his galley was involved in a major battle. Guns roared, galleys crashed into one another, oars splintered, the shards knifed through the rowers, and the blood ran in torrents. Giovanni was lucky enough to survive. His father, who was rowing on the same galley, was not. A cannonball from a Genoese ship blasted through his bench, killing Giovanni's father and three others. That oar took Giovanni everywhere, from Sicily to Istanbul. The galley belonged to the fleet of Khair ad-Din, Hayreddin Barbarossa, the ruler of Algiers and, after his visit to Istanbul, the chief admiral of the Ottoman fleet and the Beyler Bey, chief governor of North Africa. By luck, on the voyage back to Algiers, Giovanni struck up a conversation with the captain of the galley on which he rode. The captain had muttered something about the wind, almost under his breath, in the same variety of Italian that Giovanni spoke. Giovanni responded in the same tongue. The captain, it turned out, had been born a Christian as well, and a fisherman, and in a village not too far from Naples. Like Giovanni, he'd been captured by corsairs one day out on his boat. He too had pulled an oar, until he converted to Islam and worked his way up from humble sailor to a wealthy and powerful captain. Giovanni, the captain said, could do the same. He was a born sailor with useful skills. Among the corsairs, the captain told him, those who were talented and worked hard could rise as high as their gifts and luck could take them. Even back at home in the fishing village, Giovanni had rarely attended Mass. He couldn't even remember the priest's name. He had no particular attachment to the religion of his birth. Why not convert? Giovanni certainly didn't intend to spend the rest of his life chained to an oar. That path promised to be both miserable and short. He had felt the lash of the whip on his back and the utter terror of battle with no control over his fate. He didn't relish the prospect of more. Yes, he told the captain, he would convert. As soon as the galley arrived back in Algiers, Giovanni left his old life behind. He embraced Islam and took a new name, Hassan. He was a renegade now. The captain, whose name was Ali, took a liking to the young man. He could learn the corsairing trade on board his galley, under the ultimate command of the most feared man in the Mediterranean, Hayreddin Barbarossa. Before long, our two friends, the newly minted corsair Hassan and Jean the Hospitaller, would clash in battle.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Jean had never seen a galley before his trip to Malta. In fact, he had never been on a ship before. The voyage from Marseille to Naples, then Naples to Sicily, and finally from Sicily to Malta made him physically ill. He much preferred the back of a horse to the deck of a fat-bellied merchantman. And for the first time, Jean questioned his decision to join the Order of St. John. His first impressions of Malta, some 50 miles to the south of Sicily, didn't make him feel any more secure. From the deck of the merchantman, loaded with timber, gunpowder, and munitions, Jean caught his first glimpse of the island. A rocky coastline with low cliffs looming above the sea, marked with coves and small openings. Stone watchtowers, most of them half rubble, rose upward at regular intervals. Eventually, the coastline gave way to a pair of large inlets, each of which flanked a long, high peninsula jutting out into the blue waters of the Mediterranean. The southern harbor, the Grand Harbor, one of the sailors told Jean, was full of ships, most of them anchored under the walls of a partially ruined castle surrounded by a miserable-looking little town. Birgu, the sailor called it. Low war galleys competed for space with small lateen-rigged predators, the kinds of vessels that small-scale pirates liked to use. Big merchantmen, like the one on which Jean was traveling, sat at anchor next to a high-decked carrack, its sides bristling with cannon. Raised amid rolling fields and impressive castles, forests and rivers, Malta seemed like a desolate place to Jean. But it would be his home for the rest of his life. For new Hospitallers like Jean, who had just taken their oaths, one of the requirements was service on the galleys belonging to the order. Each term of service, known as a carovana, lasted for 6 months. Jean would have to undertake 4 of them over the coming 3 years. In essence, he would learn to be a Hospitaller from the deck of a warship. Sure, he knew how to swing a sword, how to fight in armor, all that, but he knew nothing of the winds and currents of the Mediterranean. He didn't know the first thing about ships or fighting in them, and he had never seen a Muslim, much less killed one. If he was going to be a warrior for God, and a seaborne one at that, it would behoove him to learn. As much as the setting and the mission were unfamiliar to Jean, the company wasn't. The men he met in the ramshackle barracks of the tumble-down castle of Sant'Angelo were much like him. The brother knights of the Order of St. John were all nobles from what he and they considered good families, whether they came from Aragon, Castile, Italy, Germany, England, Provence, Auvergne, or like him, France. As such, they shared a bunch of cultural characteristics, especially their emphasis on martial glory. They were born and bred fighters. They were all concerned with, obsessed even, with their honor and status. They liked the same kinds of chivalric stories with the same kinds of themes. Romance and violence, mostly. Of course, Jean was drawn most to the brother knights around whom he spent most of his time, the Long of France. In fact, he knew their families, either personally or by reputation. Some were related to him, cousins of more or less distant vintage. They were all nobles, and they'd all sworn the same oaths, but there was still a healthy amount of national chauvinism. As far as Jean was concerned, the Germans and English were nearly barbarians, made even more suspect by the rising tide of heresy in their lands. The Provençals and Auvergnats were nearly as foreign to Jean as the Germans and the English, despite the fact that they shared a king. Still, all of them were more familiar than the brother sergeants, the less exalted members of the order, who didn't have such noble blood. Naturally, Jean looked down on them, as he did on all non-nobles, despite their religious vocation and their participation in war. But even they had more in common than the native Maltese with their strange Arabic-sounding language and their customs that drew on a bewildering variety of Mediterranean influences. Jean wasn't on Malta long before he shipped out on a galley, bound for the coast of Greece, where he and his fellow knights would prey on shipping. Most of that shipping belonged to merchants operating out of Ottoman-held ports, but not all of it. Jean was more than a bit shocked when they boarded a merchant galley bound from Cyprus to Venice with a cargo of silk, flying the Lion of St. Mark that marked it out as a Venetian, and thus Christian, vessel. This was simply the way of things, the knight in charge explained to him. The bills had to be paid, so to speak. This voyage gave Jean his first taste of real fighting. Most of the vessels surrendered in the shadow of the knight's war galley, but a couple fought back. He heard the roar of cannons and arquebuses, the twang of bowstrings, and the thud when crossbow bolts slammed into the gunwales of ships. War cries, yells, screams, and the wails of those captured to be sold into slavery or forced to row the galleys stayed with him in the aftermath. Four times Jean went on voyages like this, four carovane. He cruised the Aegean and the Levant, picking off ships loaded down with pilgrims headed for Mecca and Medina. His first glimpses of North Africa came when his galley chased down a small corsair galleot that had taken captives from a village in Calabria, on the southern coast of Italy. Those were precisely the kinds of ships and outings that our friend Hassan, formerly Giovanni, was getting to know. His first voyage after converting to Islam and signing on to his former captor's crew had been to the coast of Calabria, where Ali, the galley captain, had led two smaller galleots on a raid. A full moon provided enough light to navigate, and quietly, their oars barely whispering as they pulled into the harbor, the three ships crept toward the village in the dead of night. First light illuminated the collection of tile-roofed huts that stretched up the hillside away from the sea, growing clearer as Hassan and his compatriots clambered onto small boats and silently rowed toward the beach. Above the shoreline, the village was still. Everybody was still asleep, and the village reminded Hassan, Giovanni, of his old home. But that was in the past, he thought, clutching an axe in his hands as he and his compatriots climbed up the hillside. Somebody's sword clanged against a rock, and up above, a dog barked. For a moment, the corsairs froze on the path. But after a beat, the dog stopped, and they continued climbing. Silently, just as most of them had done many times before, not Hassan, of course, the corsairs snuck into the village. Small groups of them gathered outside the houses, waiting for the signal. Ali, the galley captain, chopped downward with his hand. Doors splintered and slammed open as the corsairs went through. Screams and shouts erupted from inside. Dogs howled and yipped. Confusion and chaos ruled as the corsairs threw half-dressed and naked Calabrians out into the narrow dirt lanes. A few resisted, but hard blows quickly put a stop to that. Hassan was carrying a coil of rope, and he used it to bind a teenaged girl with her mother and father. The captain walked up and down the line of prisoners, casting an expert eye over them. 21, he thought, enough to make this a highly profitable voyage. He looked approvingly at the teenaged girl. She would bring a fine price, the best of the bunch, in Algiers' slave markets. The healthy men could pull an oar, just as Hassan had done. The few elderly people they didn't bother to take. There was no value in them. Other captains might have simply killed them and left their corpses to rot, but Ali considered himself a merciful man. Hassan was grateful for that, but he still felt a pang of guilt as he led his trio of captives down the hillside toward the beach and the waiting boats. Tears streaked the newly enslaved people's faces. They cried and wailed. They had good reason to, Hassan knew. His own captivity had not been pleasant. That was the first raid in which Hassan participated, but it was far from the last. Raiding for captives was the stock in trade of the violent maritime world in which he and Jean participated. The Hospitaller did the same on the coasts of Greece, Anatolia, and North Africa, packing Muslims and not a few fellow Christians into the galleys of the Order of St. John. Along with the captured cargoes of merchant ships, enslaved people were the literal currency that made this world function. Only captives fetched a high enough price to keep the corsairs in continuous business. It would be easy to look at Jean and call him a pirate with pretensions to holiness, or to see Hassan and his compatriots from Algiers as nothing but slaving raiders. But that wasn't the case. They were players. Small timers, to be sure, but still players, in a growing war that would consume their youth and their lives. Hassan, axe in hand, would be mobilized to serve the interests of the Ottoman Sultan. Jean was subject to the master of the Hospitallers, but his order was allied to the interests of the Habsburgs in the Mediterranean. We talked a little bit about the conquest of Tunis in 1535 in our last episode. It was Charles V's greatest triumph, the moment when he mobilized all his tremendous resources to a single purpose. Jean was there, him and many other Hospitallers. It was his first true battle, a chance to strap on his plate armor and swing a sword in the burning hot sun of North Africa and do battle against the Muslim foe like crusaders in medieval days gone by. Hassan was there too. Like Jean, it was his first taste of open combat. The booming of the siege guns, cannonballs shattering the masonry of the city's defenses, the war cries of the attacking Spanish, German, and Italian soldiers, not to mention the Hospitallers. All of it was more than Hassan cared to experience again. He was quite happy when he, his Captain Ali, and Hayreddin Barbarossa all escaped to their ships and made it to Algiers. Despite the setback, Hassan was making a name for himself as a corsair, and those occasional pangs of guilt he felt had long since disappeared. The years passed and the war went on. Hassan was now Ali the galley captain's protege, an increasingly skilled sailor who was learning all the tricks of the corsairing trade. Jean was rising in the order and might soon command a galley of his own. In 1538, Jean and Hassan were both present once again at the Battle of Preveza off the coast of Greece. This time it was Jean who was lucky to get away from a disastrous defeat. The Hospitaller would always remember the hundreds, thousands of corpses bobbing in the sea, sailors and soldiers and oarsmen desperately clinging to scraps of timber, the flames consuming blasted and broken ships. He didn't escape unscathed. His neatly trimmed brown beard was matted with blood from an arrow wound in the cheek that would leave a jagged, ragged scar, but it was better than being dead. For his part, Hassan earned a reputation for bravery. He led a boarding party from Ali's ship onto a Venetian galley and lost a finger on his left hand to the galley captain's sword, but cut the man's throat with a curved dagger in return. Most importantly, Hassan did this in full view of a detachment of Ottoman Janissaries and near to Hayreddin Barbarossa's flagship. Word got around, and reputation mattered. In the aftermath of Preveza, Hassan got his own ship, a small galleon, for the next corsairing voyage out of Algiers. The great Barbarossa, his now gray beard dyed red with henna, his face deeply lined and weathered by decades of exposure to sun, wind, and rain, knew Hassan by name. The fact that he was a renegade didn't hurt. Very much the opposite. A great many of the corsairs were converts, just like him. They all remembered the coastline of their old homes. It came in handy when they were cruising off the Bay of Naples and a storm blew up. Hassan guided the fleet to safety in a small harbor near to his old fishing village. Other captains who knew their old waters engaged in a bit of score settling against old enemies still on the other side of the religious divide. Hassan watched one galley captain string up a local nobleman who had evicted his family, peasant farmers near Valencia in Spain, 2 decades prior. The loot from the Spanish nobleman's manor house was just a bonus. Battle followed battle, siege followed siege. Charles tried and failed to take Algiers in 1541, another disaster that nearly cost Jean his life, in first a desperate battle, and then a raging autumn storm. The knight survived the shipwreck, washing up on the rocky shore near Algiers, but the corsairs combing the beaches took him captive afterward. Luckily, the knight had lost his surcoat with its white cross. Men like Hassan might have simply killed him instead of enslaving him if they'd known he was a Hospitaller. The 2 years Jean spent pulling an oar on a galley before he was ransomed back to the order left him with a back full of scars from the taskmaster's whip, missing teeth from a beating, and a burning hatred of Islam and Muslims. He hated the corsairs in particular, men like Hassan with a deep and enraged passion. Once he got back to Malta, for once taking pleasure in the sight of the desolate coast, Jean's focus turned to revenge. The knight got his own galley and handled it with skill and ruthlessness. He ran down corsair galleots off the coast of Spain and took merchantmen in the Aegean, within sight of the Ottoman heartland. When he killed a famous corsair captain in single combat near Crete, Jean began to build a reputation of his own. Both Jean and Hassan had names and prices on their heads. But still, this wasn't just piracy. The war got bigger. Hassan spent a winter in the French port of Toulon, part of the alliance between the Ottomans and the Kingdom of France, and participated in a joint siege. By this point, Barbarossa was an aged man, and he died safe and sound in his palace in Istanbul in 1546. His replacement was Turgut Reis, a corsair admiral who was every bit as gifted. As part of Turgut's fleet, Hassan landed on the coast of Liguria, near Genoa, sacking and burning and carrying off slaves. It was with Turgut in the coming years that Hassan first caught sight of the desolate shores of Malta himself. The corsairs made a habit of carrying off Maltese villagers, more to tweak the noses of their hated Hospitaller enemies like Jean than anything else. Sieges and battles and sieges, and the constant raiding. These were the rhythms of life for Jean and Hassan, year after year after year. They turned 30 in 1545, the year Hassan raided Liguria. The scene of war shifted to North Africa after 1550. Jean was there at the Siege of Mahdia near Tunis and participated in the massacre of the city's inhabitants after its capture. But Turgut and Hassan and the rest were a long way from done. They raided Venetian territories in the Adriatic with an Ottoman fleet the next year and took the port of Tripoli in Libya from its Hospitaller owners. Jean was lucky to get away from that one. Things weren't going well for the Hospitallers, and not just because they lost Tripoli. In 1551, that same year, Hassan and a fleet of corsairs carried off the entire population of Gozo, the island that neighbored Malta and which was also ruled by the Order of St. John. The 5,000 captives glutted the slave markets of North Africa, and it was an enormous blow to the reputation of the knights. Year after year after year, this went on. Hassan got to know every inch of the Great Sea, sailing with Turgut from Istanbul to within sight of Venice to the Western Mediterranean. The strategic situation featured victory after victory for Hassan and the Ottomans and defeat after defeat for the Habsburgs and their Hospitaller allies. Another attempt on Algiers failed in 1559. At Djerba, near Tunis, in 1560, Turgut routed a powerful Christian fleet, leaving thousands more Christian corpses bobbing in the blue waters of the Mediterranean. Hassan turned 45 years old the year of Djerba. He had long since outstripped his old mentor, Ali, and when he sailed from Tripoli or Algiers, he did so with a squadron of galleys. Ottoman Janissary agas listened to his advice. Turgut Reis himself knew Hassan was a captain to be trusted. His name was known and feared by Christians in every port from Tunis to Naples to Barcelona. He thought little about his old life. A veritable palace in Algiers, gold, slaves, warships, hundreds of sailors and soldiers. He never would have had a life like this if he'd remained a Christian. Giovanni was long since dead, and as far as Hassan was concerned, good riddance to him. Jean did much the same, albeit with less success. As he aged into his 40s, the Hospitaller picked up scar after scar and a growing reputation. But still, no matter how skilled he was, he couldn't budge the tide of war. He returned to Malta year after year, looking at the strengthened fortress surrounding the Grand Harbor, meeting with the Grand Master Jean Parisseau de la Valette, taking the newly arrived young Hospitaller nobles on their caravane to raid, fight, and despoil, just as he had. This was the way of things, the only way of life Hassan and Jean had known their entire lives. But a reckoning was coming. It would bring the two of them together at the very center of the Mediterranean. At Malta, the gateway where the battle between the Habsburgs and the Ottomans would eventually be decided. It would come in 1565. Just a few years in the future. That is what we'll talk about next time on Tides of History. The culmination of all this in the Great Siege of Malta and the Battle of Lepanto. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about here on Tides, or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman, or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.